Welcome to Abound in Hope, a podcast from Imprint Church. Our goal is to help you apply the hope of the gospel of Jesus Christ to everyday life.
All right, welcome back to Abound in Hope, a podcast from Imprint Church. I am Rex Gorman. I'm sitting in our world-class podcast studio with...
I'm Darren Larson.
Hey, this is Tom McGregor.
And we have just recently started a new podcast series that we are calling Lampstands. Darren, where does Lampstands come from? Why are we calling it Lampstands?
Yeah, in Revelation chapter 1 and 2, there is a picture of Jesus walking amongst seven golden lampstands. The lampstands represent the churches. I think really the churches all around the world, and it had specific ones in Revelation that we're talking about there, of course. But I think it gives a symbolic representation of what Jesus does in the midst of the church. So we're doing this series to kind of celebrate what God is doing in the churches around us.
Yeah.
Like even some partnerships we've been able to have with other churches that are gospel-centered and doing gospel works. And so what's been great is just being able to say like, man, we're not competing. We are on the same team. We're working to see the gospel proclaimed in our world. And so, Jesus walks not just among Imprint Church, but walks among other churches.
Yeah, that's a beautiful thing, man. I remember the first time you mentioned that to me. I get teary when I think about stuff. There's a couple things that make me cry. The church is one of them. And so when Jesus is walking amongst the church, amongst the lampstands, it's a pretty cool thing. We love that we've gotten just to celebrate stories for really this entire year on the podcast, talking through people's stories and now through stories of people who are in ministry and the churches that they've planted and the churches that they've passed on and the churches that they've planted again or whatever, you know, depending on the story. But to that end, we have a very special guest with us today. Very special guest. Who are you?
Very special. I like that. I am Justin Anderson. I am currently I am the executive pastor at All Souls Church and CEO of the Context Leadership Group. So yeah, that's, I live in Los Angeles. I'm married to Emily. I got five kids and that's about all I can handle.
Dang, yeah, that's a lot.
That's awesome. So tell me, how in the world did we get connected to Justin Anderson? Like, I'm putting you on the spot here, but tell us a little bit about your experience in us having a connection through Imprint Church.
Yeah, well, I met Darren through some kind of inbreeding and some incestuous relationships
at
some
that's
level.
Right.
So my cousin, Carrie, is married to Nathan, and Nathan is, I don't know all the
connections.
He's my
brother-in-law.
I just know Nathan told me I got to meet this guy named Darren, and so I did, and it was the best thing that ever happened to me.
That's awesome. Yeah, of course it was.
And you have five kids. Okay.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah, my wife is second. The kids are 3-3.
Amazing. Yeah. So are you from the Northwest originally, or how did you get to LA? What was your story with that?
Yeah. So let's see, the short version on my story, grew up in Portland, Oregon, actually grew up in Boring, Oregon, to be very specific, on the east side of the city there. And was kind of raised out in the country. Boring is literally B-O-R-I-N-G, Oregon. And it was a great place to grow up. But we moved to Arizona when I was about to go into eighth grade. So my family's been in the Phoenix area since 1993. I felt called to ministry when I was 16. And after what I thought would be a lengthy baseball career that was less lengthy than I anticipated, I planned to go into ministry. Didn't exactly know what that meant. You know, I figured I'd be a youth pastor or something. And then I had a chance to be a youth pastor, and I didn't like it. And turns out high school kids are the worst. And so... I played baseball my whole life, so I went to play baseball at Point Loma Nazarene University in San Diego, where I went to school, studied theology, got connected with a local church there that brought me on staff right after college. So I was a college pastor for a couple years in San Diego at the Rock Church, that's where I met my wife. So my wife Emily was going to school at San Diego State, so she was a college student, I was a college pastor. It was great.
That sounds not sketchy
totally
at all.
Totally legal. Yeah. And so we met at church, and then I felt called to ministry and specifically church planting. And I met a guy whose name was Mark, and he gave me a vision for church planting that I had never heard before. And I was pretty fired up about that.
What was that vision?
We moved to Phoenix. Say it again.
What was that vision? I'm curious. You said you kind of never heard it before. Was it just you hadn't thought about church planting in the past at all?
Or? Yeah, I didn't know it was a thing. You know, growing up in church, I was in a great church in Portland, Good Shepherd Community Church there. Great church, great pastors, Randy Alcorn, Alan Halafka, and all those guys. But church planting was just not kind of, it was not something I really knew about.
Yeah, so you just kind of thought great churches were always there.
Exactly. Yeah. Like no one ever told me the origin story of these churches. And so, you know, I had seen actually my youth pastor when I was in high school, who's this huge impact on me, went to go take over a church, you know, something, I mean, not hostile, they invited him.
You take the shit.
And it was terrible. Like it was a painful situation. And I realized like, oh, they don't just give good, healthy churches to people. they give, kind of broken ones. And so I was like, oh man, I don't know about that. And so then when I heard about church planting, I was like, yeah, that's it. I start things. I've always started things. I've always been fairly entrepreneurial. And, so that gave me a vision for church planting that I didn't have. So, when I was 24, we moved to Phoenix, with the intention of starting a church. And, I started with 10 people in my parents' living room and I was related to half of them and they were obliged to be there, you know? And we started a church and it was called Praxis. And, so I had gotten engaged. So the first year of our church plant was, our year of engagement.
Oh,
and
oh, wow.
The second year of the church plant was our first year of marriage.
Yeah.
Don't do that.
How was that? Yeah. It sounds a little painful. Imagine.
It was terrible. Yeah. We got to the end of year two. And so literally started with 10 people in my parents' living room. The end of year two, we were 75 people and felt pretty good about ourselves. My wife was miserable. I was working at Starbucks. She was working and in school still. I mean, it was it was terrible. I didn't get paid for the first 2 years of the church. And so I'm working multiple jobs and stuff and umpiring and like old man softball, which the only thing worse than doing church planting and getting married at the same time is umpiring old man softball. So, was just doing all of that. And I just remember so vividly, we were at this orphanage in, Honduras. And I told my wife, I said, we can leave. I mean, we can, not the orphanage, but the church. Like, we can, you know, this is miserable. And I can go try to get my old job back. We can move back to San Diego, whatever. And she's like, nope, the Lord's called us to this. We need to stick in it. Mm. And that's a theme in my life is me going like, we should bail. And my wife being like, no. So we stuck in it, and that fall we doubled, and then the spring we doubled again, and that fall we doubled again. And that's, I mean, it was stupid. We went from 10 to 75 people in 2 years, and then 75 to 2,000 in 4 years.
Oh my goodness.
So, yeah, it was nuts.
Do you know why? Like, is there a reason behind that? Was it just word of mouth? Was people evangelizing others? Was it, what was going on with that?
You know, Darren, if I knew that, I'd have written a book by now and would have a worldwide podcast.
You would have put it in a bottle,
Yeah. So I don't know, man. I mean, it was a combination of like, we probably sucked at it less after 2 years. And, you know, like word of mouth and the Lord's provision. And, you know, I don't know. I mean, the initial growth was pretty organic. And then after we were probably like 600 or 700 people and we were on the front page of the Arizona Republic on Easter morning. And they did a big spread on us and then we popped again. And, you know, it's just, it was kind of a wild thing, but it was a blast. And so we were there for 8 years. We went through a merger. We went from 2,000 people to 5,000 people in one day because we merged with two other churches. And so that was a wild moment as well.
Is that the culture down in Arizona in the area you were in? Like how going from 2,000 to 5,000 and a merger between two large churches seems strange.
Yeah, there's a lot about that that was strange, you know, and I think uncommon. And I mean, there's a lot more behind it, you know. my mentor, or one of my mentors in Phoenix, was a pastor of a very large church. He was getting older, nearing retirement, and his son-in-law was actually kind of his right-hand man, was one of my best friends, still is one of my best friends. And we had done all kinds of different, we had built a leadership development thing together. We built this like kind of multi-church, like collaborative thing together. Yeah. We just worked really closely together. And so there was a day where we were sitting out by the pool, and I just remember going, you know what we should do? We should merge our churches. And, you know, it was just like, 2 30-year-olds being like, yeah, that'd be cool. And so then we floated it to Tom, our mentor and the senior pastor of the other church. And I think he saw it as like the perfect kind of retirement plan. And then a church they planted joined us as well. Mm. And so we went from being Praxis Church, 2,000 people on two campuses, to being Redemption Church, which at the time was, 5,000 people on five campuses or something like that. Yeah. And now is, I don't know, there are 10 campuses and 8,000 people or something.
Yeah, complexity. I've heard of Redemption Church. So, man, that's crazy.
Yeah. 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 They're great. So Tyler Johnson's the lead pastor there, and he's a good buddy and just a great, great leader. So yeah, that was a wild time. But the crazier part of that was about a year in, we were kind of on the front end of a potential building project that was going to be like a $5 million building project thing. Huh. And I saw this like trajectory for my life where we were going to do this big building project that was going to be just an amazing building, like right in downtown Tempe, right by Arizona State University. It was just going to be awesome. And I saw kind of the next 10 years, and I went, okay, that's what I'm doing for the next 10 years. Cause you don't do that and then walk away.
Right.
And, my daughter at the time was like 5 or 6. My son was 1 or 2. I can't remember their ages or names. I just thought, you know, if we don't do something now, like we're going to be locked in here. Cause then they're going to be entering high school and whatever. And the only other thing I'd ever wanted to do in my whole life was plant a church in San Francisco. Mm-hmm. That was like my dream. And I almost did it before going to Phoenix, but I was at least smart enough to know that at 25, I shouldn't be planting a church in San Francisco.
So
then we decided to leave Phoenix and handed the church off to Tyler, who became the lead pastor. And then another guy named Ricardo Stewart, who took over. I was over kind of multiple campuses as well. And so a bunch of guys took over, and we moved to San Francisco, us and one other couple, and planted a church in the middle of the city, and embarked upon the 4 hardest years of my entire life.
Wow.
Well, by far.
Before we launch into the 4 hardest years of your life, what was it? I know there was we're going to be locked in here. What did you kind of see? How did the calling out of something that was really comfortable and really working and really successful look like? Because that seems like the least opportune time to leave. If you're like, man, this is sort of
a stable
place. Yeah. It's going really well. Was it just kind of a wild hair? Was it like a discontent in you? What was it? How did God move you from like this really stable place to something that was very unstable, but you know, yeah, but seemingly right.
Yeah, I regret it almost every day of my life. That's a little bit of an exaggeration, but part of what made San Francisco so hard was that I really did regret leaving. And I think it was one of those things where God used my my sinfulness and my immaturity to move me. And I think he wanted to move me. And I think that had I been maybe more mature and less sinful, I wouldn't have left because I would have been more content.
Yeah.
And so I think that there's a combination of things, because this is something I've thought about so much over the years. We left in 2012, and I've spent 10 years thinking about, like, why did we do that and what happened there and all of it. And I think it was a combination of, I am an entrepreneurial person. I do like new challenges. And so once we were this 5 campuses, 5,000 people thing, I think I got a little bored.
Yeah, you kind of had it figured out. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it just was like, okay, now this is what we're going to do. And we'll multiply campuses and then what? You know, it kind of seemed like the next decade was kind of mapped out. And so I think in one sense, it's just kind of how I'm wired. I think in another sense, when we did the merger, initially we had conversations about it being like, I'm at the main campus and it's video everywhere. Mm-hmm. You know, the standard like, you know, model that was the video model in the day, back in the day, you know, 2011, it was like, I was on the phone with all those guys going, they got it. You got to do video. You got to do video. And I just never wanted to do that. You know, it really was not like some high-minded, you know, philosophical difference. I was just like, I would talk to guys who were living that life and I'd go, I don't want their life. Yeah. Like I just, that's not interesting to me. And there was kind of a vanilla-ness to it and a degree to which you had to be kind of for everything. And we had campuses in college area, in downtown, in the suburb, to, you know, in the way out suburbs. And we had plans to put them all over Arizona. And I was like, I don't know that I want my job to be pastoring Arizona, you know,
That makes sense.
I don't know.
You're so far in the stratosphere there that you're not really like contextualizing at all. You're almost like, you have to pull all the contextualization out, and that makes it hard to actually pastor people. You know, you'd be a great didactic teacher that way, but
totally. And I don't want it to sound like my heart's desire was really to pastor people. That's never really been my heart's desire, if I'm totally honest. It was a lot more about the leadership part of it and the communication part of it. And I'm somebody who leads, you know, I play baseball my whole life. I'm a team guy. I got to have people around me. And I honestly was like, I don't know how to. So anyway, we decided not to do video, which meant we were doing multi-congregational, which meant I was going to be in one congregation and we were going to have pastors in these other congregations, which is what they do now. But what I started to ask myself was like, okay, well, what's my role in this? Because I lead from the pulpit and in the present. I lead my team and I lead the church from the pulpit. And I'm only going to have one team, one pulpit. How do I do that? How do I lead without the pulpit? And I was actually the first one to say, Tyler is better suited to be the leader because he can lead without a pulpit. And I don't really know how to do that. Mm. And it wasn't really, I wasn't trying to be holy or pious or godly even. I was just like, I think this is like strategically the better way to go.
Yeah.
And everyone was like, yep, we agree. And I'm like, whoa, a little pushback.
So this may be a little bit redundant of a question then, but I was going to ask you, what is a lesson that you learned at Redemption in Phoenix or in Tempe or whatever it is where you say, man, this is something I learned during that time that I've kept with me or that I learned in church ministry or church planting world that has been helpful for you?
Yeah, I learned a lot about myself. Hmm. And that's... you know, I had a counselor tell me I'm borderline narcissistic. Like, I'll take it. You add as many borderlines to that, I'll feel better. But I think, you know, my lesson at every stop along the way, and there have been many, is mostly been learning about myself. Hmm. And the way I would kind of categorize that chapter was, another mentor said this to me when I was in San Francisco, which is guys with, if you know the head, heart, hands kind of rubric, guys with head and hands gifts get opportunities their hearts aren't ready for.
Oh, man.
And I would say that was my first 10 years in ministry.
Wow.
Is exactly that. I've always been good on stage. I've always been a good kind of natural leader. And so I would get opportunity. I mean, when I was 22, 23, 24, the Rock in San Diego was 7,000 people. Yeah. And I was the second communicator. And so I was up preaching as a 23, 24 year old to 7,000 people at this national, you know, Miles McPherson's this national kind of figure. That was stupid. Like my heart was not mature enough for that opportunity, but I was good at it. And so I got opportunities because I was good at it. And so I look back on Redemption and go, most of what happened there was as much about like gifts and skills as it was about godliness or, you know, I mean, obviously the Spirit was moving and it had anointed what we were doing. But I look back on that and have some like kind of cringy, man, I can't believe I said that. I can't believe I did that. Like some real immaturity.
Amazing.
So getting back to the four hardest years of your life.
Yeah, let's talk about that for a minute.
What do you mean by that?
So you guys land in San Francisco. You guys bring one family with you. What are your expectations when you get there?
Yeah, so we had initially, so this is part of kind of what happened was when we were trying to make the decision to leave or not, it was really hard. It took us about 6 months to make this decision. And in the process of those 6 months, I was recruiting people to go with us. And so I had commitments from really three of my best friends and then my assistant and her family. So four families were supposed to come with us. And we had raised $1 million. We were we were ready to roll. After then we decided to leave, all of them backed out.
Oh my goodness.
And so that it was never the plan for me to end up there by ourselves.
Yeah,
and in fact, the family that did come with us was a family that we had initially said no to because I was concerned that it wouldn't be a good fit.
Oh man. Okay.
And I was right. So we
you guys
kind of
like
there.
Airdrop in then it's like, you and the misfits.
Yeah. And I knew one other pastor there and that's it. We didn't have connections. We didn't have people. We had nothing. And so we showed up, our family and this other family he was a worship guy. He's a great guy, godly guy. There just was like, it just wasn't a good personality fit.
Yep.
So it's not about him. But it was just hard from day one because I was like, this isn't what I signed up for. Like I'm not a pioneer, you know, church planner guy, like hacking through the jungle. That's not who I am. Like I'm a leader of people and team and all of that.
And
so I built
they?
A team. So it was initially like, man, I didn't sign up for this. And that's when I think a lot of my immaturity and kind of selfishness was revealed, where I kind of in some ways went, this is what I signed up for. So I'm not doing it. Like, you know, and kind of had a little pity party about it. And I don't know that I ever emotionally really got over that. And so I got connected with a counselor who, a guy named Jeff Schulte, who runs Tin Man Ministries, just amazing guy. Like I always say, Jesus saved my life, but Jeff Schulte helped. Huh. And it just was a really critical person for me. And I remember our very first conversation where he goes, tell me what do you feel? And I'm like, I feel pissed. He's like, let's unpack that. You know? And I didn't have language. I didn't have the ability to communicate what I was feeling and so over the course of 2 years, really teasing it all out and helping me just kind of get a hold of what I was feeling. And the reality was I didn't know how to mourn. I didn't know how to grieve. I didn't know how to express, you know, feelings of fear or loss or loneliness. And I had to learn that while planting a church in the middle of San Francisco. And so all of that was really, really hard. Kind of ironically, and this is where I know the hardship of San Francisco was about what God was doing inside me.
Gotcha.
Because the church did well. You know, we were there. We landed there not knowing anybody. After 2 years, we were about 200 people. We were a dead center in the city. We had this great house, this great living situation, cheap rent in San Francisco. Whoa. On this quiet street. It was insane.
Yeah.
Everything external was good, and I was blind to it.
Mm-hmm.
I just couldn't see it.
Man.
And I couldn't be thankful for it. I couldn't appreciate it. I couldn't see what God was doing in it. And I just had this feeling of I just do this every time where I'm like, ugh. I was just angry and dissatisfied. And, you know, I never yelled at anybody. I never stole money. I didn't sleep with anybody. I think people just got tired of me, tired of my negativity is ultimately what it was. So we had this group, you know, a kind of advisory team, an elder advisory team, and they're some of my best friends to this day. In fact, the guy I work with here in LA was on that team. Tyler Johnson was on that team. Luke Hendricks was on that team.
No way.
I mean, some
awesome.
Really, really great cool. men who I still love. And they came to me one day and said, hey, we think you need to leave and not come back, was the short version. And, you know, they said, we think you need to get healthy. And we don't think you can get healthy while you're also planting a church in San Francisco. And so they gave me 6 months of severance and said, don't do anything for 6 months. Just go get healthy. And that was a gift, a huge gift. But it was the greatest gift I've ever received that I never want to receive again.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah. So how did you respond to that? You're like executive guy. You're like
you're a builder.
You like doing things. You're a leadership guy. What were those 6 months like? Did you kind of feel like you were in exile, or what was that about?
Yeah, I spent the first three wondering if I should be a pastor anymore, mostly. And that's tied to bigger. I still wonder that. I had another mentor. I can tell my life story with just male mentors in my life. But one of them, the guy who is my business partner now, once said to me, people get tired of having a strategist as their pastor. And I took that personally, because I have experienced that. And I think that's true about me. And I've often said, I wake up in the morning thinking about the future and about the organization. What are we doing as a church, as an organization? What are we doing and where are we going? I don't wake up thinking about the people. I have to remind myself to think about the people. And so that is an advantage in some ways. It's helped me build several successful church plants that all are still going and thriving today. And it's bit me in the butt at times when people don't feel cared for by me. My time, that the first 3 months of my sabbatical were spent me going like, should I just be a really Christian business guy, or, should I do something else? And God kind of reaffirmed like, no, I mean, maybe someday, but not yet. And so it wasn't as bad as it sounds, because it was kind of nice to be forced to wrestle with things, and to do that was actually pretty awesome. We went back to Phoenix, which was hard because I was a hero back there. And so to have to tell the story over and over and over was really challenging, but really freeing. In fact, there were some guys at the same time as me going through had lost guys in Acts 29 in particular, who all at the same time lost their churches. Yep. Mm-hmm. And I found myself in a position of counselor and advice giver to some of these guys. And my advice to them was the advice I'd received from my counselor, which was tell the worst version of the story over and over and over. Like, don't exaggerate it, but tell the worst version. So don't be like, well, I had some hard times and, they made a decision. Like, no, I was like, no, I was a jerk. They got tired of me. They told me to go away. That's what happened. And now I got to wrestle with that.
Doing that was
life-changing.
Yeah. In a season of kind of time where it seems like we keep hearing story after story of churches that are losing pastors because of leadership issues in some ways, are you seeing like kind of writing on the wall from some of your own experiences that you've had in the past as you're looking at some of the current stories and say, man, I've seen that red flag, I feel that, or whatever it is? Is there some commonalities there? Am I reading into this a little bit?
Oh, no, for sure. It's one of the most dangerous things about leadership culture in evangelical churches. And I'm pro evangelical church. So this is a critique from the inside, but we don't create space for pastors to struggle out loud.
Yeah, that's true.
And we don't create culture where a pastor can go, I'm really having a hard time, and not like, oh, I'm struggling with lust, but like, no, guys, this is for real. I'm feeling burnt out. Like, no, I hate you guys.
Yeah.
And there's no space to be really honest and not have your job be on the line. And I think that all that does is it promotes a culture of hiding until you get found out and it's too late. But if you could do it on the front end and go, hey, like I just was working with a group of guys talking about working together on something. And I said, here's what you need to know about me. And I told them the five worst things about working with me, because I'm like, this is eventually, it's one of these things that will make you hate me. Wow. So I want you to know ahead of time, so that we can be aware of them. So not having that culture of being able to go, here's the way, if I'm going to go down, it's not going to be women. It's not going to be money. It's not going to be alcohol. It's going to be, I'm a jerk. That's what it's going to be like. So keep me honest about the jerk stuff.
How have you, in subsequent context, how have you built in the culture of honesty and vulnerability?
Yeah, it's the best thing about church planting is I get to set the culture and I don't have to change the culture, which is, you know, is just a different challenge, but it's nice to have a blank slate. And so a couple of the things that, you know, when we started Icon, if we can fast forward a little bit to Icon, we established these, these values that we have. And one of them was a value for confession, vulnerable confession. Right. Because we wanted to establish a culture from day one. And this is something I did and I led the way. And I, from the pulpit, from the very beginning, was like, here's where I'm struggling with this. And this is almost every sermon, you know, one of the turning points is going to be, here's what I hate about this passage and where it convicts me, because this is what I don't want to do, or this is who I don't want to be. Mm-hmm. And I fight this because this is in me, whether it's arrogance or narcissism or selfishness or whatever. I want to name it, and I want to name the worst version of
it.
Not like, I struggle with being, you know, no, like, I'm bad at this. I commit this sin over and over and over, and I am in need of grace for this. And that sets the bar in really helpful ways. But also just establishing, like, if we really believe in grace, like, grace requires sin. Mm. Like, there is no grace if there is no confession of sin. And so it's assumed. And so I would tell the story all the time, like, walking, I went, this is a longer story, but I had a season where I went through an AA program. I'm not an alcoholic, never been an alcoholic. It was part of this other kind of experience thing that I had. But the great thing about AA is walking through the door is a confession of alcoholism.
Yeah.
Right? So you walk in and there's no pretense. There's no one walking around being like, well, I'm
all right. I stumbled in here.
No, yeah.
You wouldn't be there, right? So, like, church ought to be the same thing. I'm here because I'm a sinner, and not like I'm a sinner like all of us, but like I sinned just now in my head, you know, like I that's why I'm here. And so the pretense around I've got this thing together is stupid. You're like a guy at AA pretending he's not an alcoholic. Like, that doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
If that's true about you, you should leave, because church isn't that interesting, right? Unless you really need grace.
Yeah.
And so, man, talking about that stuff, and man, that phrase of like, tell the worst version of it, just has become kind of a mantra for me.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so you got past your San Francisco experience a little bit here. I'm curious what brought you up to the great Pacific Northwest? How, you know, since you're in LA now, we have a whole piece of your story we've not got to yet.
Yeah, so when we were in Phoenix, I had people reach out, and we, you know, considered a number of different things to do next. One of those was Jeff Vanderstelt, who was the pastor, the lead pastor at Doxa Church. Jeff and I have known each other forever through Acts 29, and so he called and said, hey, would you want to come up here and help us turn Mars Hill main campus into Doxa? And you guys know Jeff well enough to know Jeff is a visionary. He's an idea guy, and not the organizational leader at the same level of visionary. Yeah. And so they hired me to be kind of the person to help turn things organizationally and to do some leadership development and share the pulpit and all those kinds of things. I think it was an olive branch little bit because they love me. And so that's what initially brought us to Seattle. And so the plan was always 2 to 3 years at Doxa. And partly because, you know, some of the other roles that we had opportunities for were lead pastor roles. And I was afraid to step back into a lead role, not knowing if I could do it.
Yeah,
in a healthy way, you know.
How long How long was it before you came, or after you came to Seattle, was the Mars Hill meltdown? Like, what part were you in that, by the way, from that?
It was after. So I came after. So it was already Doxa when they hired me.
Gotcha.
So Mars Hill melted down at the end of 14.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yep.
Yeah, and we moved up summer of 16.
Okay, great. Yep.
I think that's right.
Yeah, yeah.
Summer of 16.
Fair enough.
So about a year and a half after the meltdown. So the plan was always 2 to 3 years. I wanted to see, I knew that if I could do ministry in a healthy way, I'm a lead guy. That's how I'm wired. So the question was, can I do it in a healthy way? And Doxa was a great opportunity for me to go, not have to be the lead guy, make sure I can kind of reestablish healthy rhythms. And then if I can, I'll need to probably move into something else. And so we did that. We were there for about 2.5 years, and probably 2 years in, started to kind of go, okay, there's a trajectory. We need to probably wrap things up here. And then again, kind of looked all over the country at different things, and through a series of conversations, decided to plant. Part of my job at Doxa, I lived in Seattle. Doxa's on the east side, so I was kind of over all the community groups on the in Seattle proper, and so that was a built-in core group. So we had 40 people who were at our first core group meetings, and so we decided to plant. So we planted. We left Doxa at the end of 2019. So the first 9 months of 2020 was. Am I getting this right? No. When was COVID?
COVID was 2020.
I know, that's a legitimate question.
So we left 19. So the first three quarters of 2019 was core group building. We launched Icon in the fall, September of 2019.
Yeah.
And then 6 months later, COVID. Oof. It was just another one of those, it was going really well. We hit 200 within 6 months, and we were in Capitol Hill. Our church was inside the Capitol Hill Autonomous Zone. It was just kind of crazy how the whole thing happened and played out, and then COVID. And basically, I can tell you next why I left, but that's kind of how we got to Seattle.
Was the experience there a helpful, kind of cool moment of learning to pastor a group of people and kind of lead them and shepherd them again? Was it a good experience for you in that?
Yeah.
Great.
Yeah. I mean, I think the Seattle experience was generally positive for me. I loved what we were doing with Icon. I loved what we were doing with our school. I was on the board for my kids' school. It was great. It was all really, really positive. Being in Capitol Hill was an experience unlike anything I've experienced. And, it's like I always tell people, I planted in San Francisco.
Yeah, I was going to say that.
And so it's not like I came from Topeka and was like, this place is crazy. I was in San Francisco, and Seattle had a level of aggression around their progressiveness that outstrips San Francisco without question.
Wow.
Right. So I always love telling the story, but we were renting from a Lutheran church there in Capitol Hill, and they were a full-on affirming, liberal church. In fact, the very first meeting I had with their pastor, she asked me, where are you at on LGBT stuff? And I said, we're conservative on that. She's like, okay, I figured, I know my board will ask. So we started meeting there. They drive her out in six months later. She's driven out. One of the elders of the church is a gay man, sits down with me at a coffee shop in Capitol Hill and drops an F-bomb on me about our position on trans people. And I'm like, well, this is unique.
Yeah.
I have never been F-bombed by a gay elder about our position on trans people.
Yeah.
And so that one's going in the memoir for sure. But that was what we were dealing with there in Capitol Hill. And, we got a little bit of the picketing and some of that stuff as well. But it was for me, it was like, this is why we're here.
Totally.
If I wasn't ready for that, I would have gone to Topeka.
Yeah, exactly.
I remember when you came and talked to our board about it, I mean, yeah, several years ago now, and just shared the vision of Icon Church and what you guys were doing. We've a tradition has been, because we're a church plant. I mean, we're 10 years old this year as Imprint Church. But I remember those days of like, man, church planting and just wanting some relationship, networking, support, all of those things. And when you came and shared the vision of kind of going into the city a little bit and kind of taking the message of the gospel into Capitol Hill, I went, there's not many doing that right now.
Yeah.
And that is a pretty amazing thing to think that that could possibly be even an option. And so we were pretty excited. I remember praying for you and being part of this thing and saying like, okay, Lord, would you do a miracle there in that area and to see what Icon's going to do. So can you catch us up on what's Icon doing now and all that stuff too? What's happening at the church now?
Yeah. So we made it through the pandemic and came out on the other side, certainly reduced from beforehand, but came out on the other side healthy. The church was in a good spot. Personally, the pandemic, I think, was really clarifying for a lot of people and certainly for us. So my wife had struggled in Seattle from day one. In fact, the very first time Vanderselt called me, I got off the phone and said, hey, Jeff called me and is interested in us coming to Seattle. And she goes, cool, you should do that. So it was pretty clear from the beginning. She was like, this is what God wants for us. I'm in because this is what God wants for us, but this is not my favorite. And so... When the pandemic hit and everything was kind of stripped away, people were stripped away, events and basically all the distractions, and it was just her and Seattle, and that just it kind of the dam broke, you know. And totally. I remember one day saying, what is it about Seattle, like specifically, that's hard? And she said, the weather, the people, and the culture. I was like, okay,
is that all?
That's
okay.
It. So it was just kind of this moment of like, you know, you come home and see your wife in the fetal position enough times from depression, and you kind of go, well, I think we need to make a move here. And so it became when, not if, at a certain point. And then when became now. And so we moved last summer. We had a guy that we had hired actually from the Village Church in Texas.
Oh, yeah.
He had come up to do community groups for us and had been teaching probably 12 weeks a year. And so we handed the church off to him, and it's going great. He's doing a great job. He's hired. The staff is now almost completely turned over, but they're still in Capitol Hill. They're still doing a great job, and we talk regularly. So
that's cool.
So now we're in LA.
And you lead you're actually an elder at a church as well as you started your own company. Tell us just briefly about that out of curiosity, both those things.
Yeah. So during the pandemic, like many people, I picked up a side hustle because I was bored. And so a good buddy of mine named Brian Howard, who is the executive director of Acts 29, had, you know, for years done coaching and consulting and some staffing. And he had had a church reach out to him and asked to help him find an executive pastor. He was coaching me at the time and said, hey, would you want to help me with this? And so I became kind of the recruiter on that role.
Yeah.
And we just talked more and more and more, and I became a partner, and so all of that happened during the pandemic. And so it's kind of a lead. So we do coaching, consulting, and staffing, and it was just kind of a side thing. But then once it became clear we needed to move, we started kind of going, okay, could we rev this up and have this be more, you know, more of what I do? Because there's elements that I really enjoy. It's a lot of the organizational stuff I'm good at without the people that I'm bad at. And so, so that's good. And then, I had a buddy down here, in LA named Harvey Turner, who I'd known for years through Acts 29. And, they were doing kind of a church restart, old church here in LA, where in fact, we're right across the street from Walt Disney Studios.
No way.
And, it's really cool. Like right outside this door is the big arch. It says Walt Disney Studios, and where they do all the feature films and all that, is right there. So, really cool old mid-century building and a total restart. There was 15 people on my first Sunday. And so he's like, hey, why don't you come help me? And so I am technically the executive pastor, which just means I'm his admin, basically.
Are you the bad guy?
So.
Oh, and you get to preach.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm still preaching probably 20 weeks a year.
Oh, that's great. Yeah,
and
that's
awesome. I travel, and people bring me in to preach as well sometimes too. So it's good.
That's really cool. Well, man, there's something about hearing the stories of what God's doing in the lives of pastors, people in ministry, and things like that that gives people a vision for church, you know, planting, church ministry in general. And so, like, I think the last question I'd ask you before we kind of let you go to respect your time, I told you we'd only take you for an hour. So, is there anything that you might? Oh, and then we're going to pray for you too. I'll tell you about that in a second. But is there anything you might say to? Those people who are considering like church planting in the future, because we are trying to find a second location building again right now. And what kind of advice would you say that you would give? You've seen this a few times. This is a road you've walked on. What would you say to people who are considering church planting to go and just be a part of the community? What is it? What is it like? What, you know, what just I'm pitching you a softball off the plate, over the plate here.
Yeah, I mean, are you specifically to church planters or to people joining a church plant?
People joining a church plant. If they're part of Imprint Church, we've been together since the pandemic started again. And so we used to have two locations. And so both locations were doing great. Really grateful for what the Lord was doing. We're back down to one location, and about half our church seemed to turn over during the pandemic. And about a third of our church is brand new in the last 2 years. You know? So. It's a new thing. But so now we're starting to pitch the idea of having a second location again, which is really a church plant because it's has a lot of autonomy except for budget and board.
Yeah.
And so like, what would you say to people who are considering like, I want to go off with a church plant again?
Yeah, I think the best kinds of core group people are people who have a desire to see their neighbors come to know the Lord. And I think the best church planting often is done kind of geographically, right? So you guys would look at, you know, you're in Bothell, want to go to Woodinville or vice versa, or whatever it is. And you, you go, hey, we want to do this because we want to better serve and reach this community. And I think when your people have a vision for their neighbors, their city, not just evangelism, but discipleship and mercy ministry and care and all those things. But really what their heart is, I want to see this happen near me. And if that's there, man, that's the best kind of core group member because they go, hey, what do we got to do? Like, what do we got to do to get this done? And the best thing about planting churches is it reorients people's, the way they think about church changes, right? So when we are just trying to find a church, the questions we're asking, and they're very natural questions, are like, does this meet my needs? Is this, does this have what I want? Is this the preaching good and whatever? Like, it becomes about me. Church planting reorients that to be outside of us.
Yeah,
and it becomes about the church or about the neighborhood, the city. And man, that is such a powerful thing. If for no other reason, I think church planting is valuable for that reason, because it reshapes the way people think about church and their involvement with it. And so those are the kinds of people you want in a core group.
That's super cool.
You were going to answer the question for church planters as well.
Yeah, I'm curious about that. Yeah, totally.
Yeah, I think, you know, I work with a lot of church planters, coach church planters, and my involvement with Acts 29. And I would say, as much as my orientation towards the entity of the church or the organization of the church can be a drawback to me, I also see a lot of churches get stuck at 50 to 75 people because they don't think about that.
Yeah.
And a lot of guys get into church planting because they want a pulpit. And or because they want to, you know, like shepherd people. And both of those things are great. But the missing link I see often is the strategic side. The guys who are going like, let's think well about how to do this. And the reality is like, if you don't think about that and you're not oriented towards that at the beginning where you can kind of get away with it, the worst case scenario is that your church grows. Because then it just multiplies that gap.
Yeah.
And so I was working or talking to a guy at a church who ended up not working with us. And they grew like crazy during the pandemic because of certain choices they made. And they went from like 500 to 1,500 people. And it all it did was exacerbate all of their
gaps. Problems. Yeah.
And so they still don't have like employee reviews. They don't have like clear communication strategy, like nothing, like because they didn't want that. He's just kind of a MacArthur guy and he wants to teach the Bible and, right. You know, and now the organization is kind of a mess. And what happens is people slip through the cracks, people get burned out. And eventually it goes sideways and falls apart. So
yeah.
I would just say, like, if you're a planter that loves the pulpit, loves the people, that's awesome. Get training around or care about the
or
actual
find someone
organization.
Around
at the end of the day,
help. Yeah.
Yeah. You're running a nonprofit. You'd better do it well.
Cool. It's great advice. So, brother, thank you. This has been a gift. I appreciate your perspective. I appreciate your honesty.
Yeah,
by the
totally.
Way, too. You shared some vulnerable things with us. Wasn't totally expecting that.
Yeah. And, I love the whole tell the worst version of the story thing. That's a great thing to rehearse over and over again.
That may become a little bit of a theme around here. We might use that. Can I steal that from you, Justin? Is that okay?
Yeah, please. I stole it.
Yeah. and so I guess we close with how can we be praying for you? And what we're going to do is every one of these lampstands things, what we're asking our people to do as soon as the podcast gets done, to pause for a minute and pray for a few minutes for the requests. And I want to pray for two things. One is you. How can we pray for you and your family? And two, and maybe all souls, because we love churches. And two, yeah. How can we pray for Icon Church, since we have a vested interest in them as yeah. a partner in the gospel here in the Seattle region? I don't know if you can answer those briefly.
Yeah, definitely. So pray for us just as a family. You know, we're still kind of new here. We're coming up on a year in LA, but I think establishing home, you know, establishing yeah. rhythms and yeah. connections and relationship and, you know, layers of relationship is something every time we move, we start over. And,
yeah.
You know, that wears on you, wears on your kids. And so
I
think establishing home is yeah. is a big prayer request for our family, for sure. You know, all souls, just pray for, you know, some good kind of momentum and traction, in the community. And just that we would, you know, be a faithful gospel witness here on, you know, in the shadow of Disney.
Yeah.
As far as Icon goes, you know, they have experienced a lot of staff turnover, and I think it's good staff turnover. The guy, Josh, who took over for me is just really different than I am, and he needs a different team. And a lot of our original staff was my connections and relationships. And so when I left, they left. And so I think reestablishing like their team and their identity as a team and kind of their leadership and what that's going to look like, yeah. especially for Josh as a first time lead pastor.
Yep.
I think that's my prayer request for them for sure.
That's awesome.
Yeah. Well, man, you've been where you are for like a year. So that means in like what, three years, you're going to plant another church. Something like yeah. that. That's what's coming down.
I rebuke you in the name of the Lord.
Oh man, I'm just kidding. But thank you so much for sharing with us. Like that, this has been great. Thanks for telling your stories again, really honestly, really openly. Imprint Church, as soon as this is over, as soon as you hear little stinger music at the end, stop, pray for Justin, pray for all souls, pray for Icon. Man, seriously, thanks for being here. Anything you want to say to our church before we sign off? Or?
I love you guys, and I'm thankful for you. Thank you for your support of Icon. I loved my chance to come preach there many years ago now, and think of you often. So thank you.
Yeah, you got it.
Thanks, brother. Good to have you here. Thanks, good to see you.
Yeah, yeah. All right, guys, we'll be back next week with another story from another pastor, and we'll see you then.
Thanks for listening. For more information and resources from Imprint Church, you can download our app or head to imprintchurch.org.